all about staying on the air right now. It's all about staying on the air. It's all about, like, event after event after event to keep people interested and watching. People getting shot, people getting stabbed, people, you know, having sex for no rhyme or reason. But I get it. I understand. I'm not putting it down. I understand why they're doing that, because it's all about staying on the air. You know, nobody's focusing on, well, what will this mean for the story 2 years from now? Because Dave doesn't know if it has it 2 years from now.
On today's edition of Daytime Confidential, Luke and I welcome former Days of Our Lives associate head writer Tom Cassiello. Tom, welcome to the Daytime Confidential podcast.
Thank you. Glad to
welcome.
Be here.
It's a pleasure to have you. I can't wait to visit with you about your experiences.
In case anyone else hasn't heard about them yet.
some may not have.
You're right.
I have an interesting story to tell. I actually met Tom on MySpace. I was basically searching like crazy for anyone who had worked in the soaps to give me advice on breaking in, and Tom actually responded to my obsessive fanboy questions and let me cyberbend his ear several times after that, and I just want to take this time out to say thank you on the air.
Aww. I was wondering if you're going to bring that up, because that was months before my blog really went public.
Right, definitely.
And people even knew about it, and you had found me. And the thing is I remember being like 19, 20, 21 and trying to find any information at all about how to break into the business, and there was nothing.
Right.
Nothing at all. So anything I can do to help anyone now, I'm happy to do it.
Well, that was awesome. I mean, I told everyone when you wrote me back, I was like, the Associated Writer of Days actually responded. So that was awesome.
Right on. Well, I'm glad it helped.
Jamie's told me that you grew up as a diehard fan, and you dreamed of writing about soaps. That's not necessarily the story that many writers in the industry who may have came from film or theater or even writing novels have made the jump that way. How did you make that transition from being a soap fan to a soap writer?
I always knew I wanted to be a writer of some sort, but I really like stability. And I didn't want to have to move to LA and try and sell a screenplay and be a waiter for months and months and you know, sell my soul trying to get something of mine made. So I grew up with soaps. My grandmother watched ABC. My mother watched NBC. And I thought, well, this is something that really interests me and I really want to do. And I thought, you know, it's a smaller market. There's probably not that much competition to get into it. Most people I went to film school with were all about, you know, getting their films made. Nobody was really trying to get into TV. And you know, I was also, I was a little older, but I was the generation that first had the internet. And I remember being in high school and having Prodigy and being on message boards. And that was when people really started to talk about who the writers were and who these names were in the credits. And that really didn't exist before, like, 92, 93. And so, like, I started following the writers more and, like, what their styles were and what worked and what didn't work. And I was really focused on being a soap writer. And I went to film school and I asked everybody I knew, you know, do you know anybody who can get me in the door of this? And most people didn't. And then finally I found one person who was my screenwriting teacher who had gone to college with Leah Lehman. And he called her and she set me up with an interview to be an intern at Another World, and that was that.
Wow.
So, I mean, I'm so grateful for it. I mean, it was such a case of being, you know, in the right place at the right time. It was a lot of hard work, man, because when you walk into those places, they want you to be a fan, but they don't want you to be a fan, if you know what I mean.
Right.
And so you really have to work your ass off to prove that you're a hard worker and you're not going to be starstruck, and that, you know, you really want to make this happen and you really, like, believe in this, and prove that you're not there just to, you know, meet Jake McKinnon.
Okay.
You know? Because there were a lot of interns who would go through those doors, and I saw a lot of them at World Turns, too, when I worked in the writer's office, who were just there to meet their favorite actors. And they didn't want to work, so...
they say everything happens for a reason. So obviously something did happen for a reason for you being there and making it.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. I definitely do. You know, and it all just kind of fell into place after that. I didn't think I was going to get a chance to do anything else after Another World went off the air. And I was all ready to go back to school and finish up my senior year when I got the phone call, you know, that they wanted me to be the writer's assistant at World Turns. So I definitely feel like, you know, there was a reason for everything. You know, not to get all existential or anything, but I definitely do feel that way.
Well,
But again, you have to work. Like, it's not just getting your foot in the door. Like, you really have to prove yourself.
Definitely.
You know, so part of it was luck and part of it was work.
Well, keeping in that vein, I know we had talked a bit about that. We just did an interview with founding editor of Soap Opera Weekly, Mimi Torchin, who said that she believes the industry needs to go about training more soap fans to write for the industry, which that, you know, I loved hearing that. she said that basically... we talked about why it could be difficult, and I know you and I had discussed that, and you just kind of hit on that, that it's kind of hard sometimes to prove to people that you're not just there to meet the Jake McKinnons or the Marlenas. What advice would you give a fan who has writing ability in this current state of the industry about breaking in?
Well, if you find yourself with your foot in a door, I mean, I can't really give advice on how to get your foot in the door because it happens differently for everybody.
Right.
But, you know, if you somehow find yourself with your foot in the door, just stand tall. Just stand tall. Don't try and change everything. Don't try and insert your two cents into everything. But just do your job. Prove to them that, like, you can take direction. You can do what you're told. You can stay late. You can work on a history project. You can work on legal research. And no matter what anybody says about, like, oh, they wrote fanfic 5 years ago, which I did, by the way. I wrote fanfic before I got the internship. And when they found out about that, it was like, ooh, he's one of those fans. but you know what? Don't fight with anybody. Don't argue with anybody. Just say, yep, I did that, and go back to your work. You know, and stay until 9, 10 o'clock if you have to finish it and prove to them that you know what you're doing.
You got your start in soaps on the production side of Another World mm-hmm. in 1998. You were there till the end, which I just have to say as a side note, I still have a copy of that last episode on VHS, which someday I will get transferred to DVD. What was it like working on a show that you grew up watching?
It was surreal. It was really surreal. I mean, it took everything in me not to be starstruck. But I really, really, really wanted this, and I really wanted this career for myself. And so I really, like, every day I would force myself to just keep my emotions in check and walk into the studio and do my job. And it was strange. It was wild. And then being there for the cancellation and there are no words to describe it. There are no words to describe it. It was the strangest, most surreal experience of my life because I learned so much from so many people about how a soap opera is run and the kind of assembly line machine it is. And when you work in production, and I cannot recommend working in production enough to everybody out there, like, if you want to be a writer, that's wonderful. Work in production first because you will learn so much about how these shows operate, and it will totally, totally influence your writing for the better. But it just... getting to know these people and getting to know them as people and not as their characters and you know, not as names and credits, but just getting to know them for who they are and their families and their kids and their husbands and their wives. It was just really, really spectacular and really special, and I'm so grateful for every minute of it. I really am. And getting to be there on that last day and being on the studio floor when they shot the last scene with Charles and Vicki Wyndham, like, there are no words. There are no words.
Maybe a lot of tears.
I'm so blessed for it. A lot of tears. Well, the funny thing is, I told this story before, like 2 days after the cancellation announcement came, everybody who worked in the studio got a free copy of the Another World 35th Anniversary book. And everybody in the building was running around trying to get everybody else to sign their book. And it was just like a high school yearbook.
Oh.
It was just, I mean, actors would come up to me, an intern, and be like, will you sign my book? you know, and it was all like, you know, have a great summer. Hopefully we'll work together again.
Oh,
I mean,
wow.
It was really just, it was spectacular. I still have it. It's, you know, I very rarely take it out and look at it because it's way too emotional, but it's right up in my bookcase. I see it there all the time. It's like my prized possession.
That's awesome.
It was very
cool. Keeping in that vein, I don't want it to be too emotional for you, but the cancellation of Another World and later Sunset Beach sort of began the rumblings about NBC not being as committed to the continuation of the daytime soap as a genre as other networks. How did that affect the mood on the set of Another World in those last few months?
Well, obviously, for a long time there was a lot of buzz that they were going to get canceled. And I remember Chris Gautman's assistant, who is wonderful and one day should write a book because she's been the assistant to the executive producer at Another World for like 25 years.
Oh, wow.
And that survived all the different regimes. And like she's
Paul
Rout
and
really
everybody.
Oh, yeah. She was around. She got hired like in 82 or something. And she's been there ever since. And she's like everybody's, you know, den mother at the studio. She's wonderful. But like every time the phone rang and the caller ID said NBC, you know, there'd be this, like, hush in the production office. Like, oh, my God, NBC's on the line. Honestly, we had heard, like, a week or two before we got the announcement, we had heard that whoever did survive in May was still going to be canceled in December.
And that's what happened. Wow.
That's what happened. And we had heard that rumor. So honestly, like, all the actors are pulling together. It was a great cast, a wonderful cast, who totally believed in that show and wanted it to keep going. But once that rumor hit, we all thought, like, all right, we'll do the best we can, but, you know, this might be completely out of our hands. We could perform Shakespeare, and the decision's still made. And sure enough, that's what came to pass. You know, we were canceled in May, Sunset Beach was taken off in December.
Oh, boy. Just thinking about Another World getting canceled from a fan's perspective is just one of those things. I don't want to dwell on it too much. But from Another World, you went to As the World Turns, where you started at starting as a writer's assistant, and eventually you were promoted to a breakdown writer. Tell us what it was like to work for Hogan Shepherd during that period on As the World Turns.
This is not the answer anyone expects, and I've told Hogan this many times, so he already knows it. You know, I was really loyal to Leah. Leah had given me the internship. She hired me as her assistant. She was there for a year. This is not to say I was a fan of every story she wrote or hated every story she wrote, for that matter, but, like, in terms of, you know, personal likes and dislikes, I was really loyal to her. And I remember as the assistant being told, like 2 months before Hogan started, like, you need to start sending breakdowns to this guy in California. And immediately I was like, I don't know who he is, but I hate him. I can already see the writing on the wall. The ratings are down. Some guy who doesn't know anything about anything is going to come in. It's going to be another Black and Stern. Like, I was all set to just, like, you know, give him the cold shoulder. And he walked in, you know, 2 months later, and was just the most outgoing, friendly, lovable, funny, just down-to-earth guy I'd ever met. Just completely, he'd worked in Hollywood for 20 years. He hung out with all of these A-list stars because his brother is, you know, Craig Sheffer, as everybody knows, and was so down-to-earth. Like, he'd met all these people and had all these experiences, but, like, it meant nothing to him. Like, that wasn't what was important in life at all. And he was just so happy to be there and to try something new and to do something different. And when they made him the offer to be head writer, you know, 8 weeks after he started writing Breakdowns, he actually said, I need a co-head writer because I've never done this before. I don't really understand how soaps work. I can write you a story, and I can, you know, involve all the characters on the canvas, but, you know, I don't know the rules of soap opera, and I don't want to be arrogant enough to say I can do this without any help. I need help, which is, you know, why Carolyn became his co-head, and he was just wonderful. He was fantastic, and when he failed at something, he acknowledged it, which I hadn't seen from a lot of head writers. When he succeeded, he was humble, and he was always open to ideas from, you know, the other writers in the room, always. And he's still like that to this day.
You're no longer with As the World Turns, for people who may not be aware of it. You're no longer with As the World Turns, but in a recent blog post on your blog, you said that it was the happiest time of your life.
Yeah.
And you go on to tell a story about Alan Dolan. And for those people who may have not read your blog, would you be willing to share that story real quick with people? Because it was really sort of a neat story.
This just happened last night. I was taking friends of friends out for dinner and drinks in the city, and we were on the subway platform going home at 1 a.m., and I was showing them the subway map and you know, where they had to go to get back to their hotel room. And this hand tapped me on the shoulder and said, "Tom," and I turned around, and it was Ellen, and she was coming back from seeing a friend's play. And she had actually and my friends later told me they had seen her kind of off in the corner looking at me, like staring, and they were like, "Who's this crazy woman staring at this guy?" She had followed me down to the subway platform, and she was like, "I think that's Tom. I'm not sure. I think it is." And finally she got up the nerve to come over and, you know, ask. And of course it was me. And I was so thrilled to see her because I hadn't seen her since like 2002 or three maybe. And we caught up and everything. And it was really wonderful because it reminded me why I loved that time at World Turn so much, because everybody knew everyone's names. Everyone knew everyone's, like, they asked about your wife, your kids, your boyfriend, your girlfriend. I mean, it was such a family environment, and it was so collaborative. And when I was there for those few years, there were very few egos. It was all about getting this show from that used to be like the pinnacle of daytime when Marlon was writing it. It was now like number 6 or 7 in the ratings, and we really wanted to get it up. And to be part of that and to actually witness the show rising in the ratings, getting nominated for Emmys, winning Emmys with all of these people who got along really well. I mean, those were my closest friends back then in my life, and to some extent, they still are. I still keep in touch with everybody from World Turns because it was just a really tight-knit group. Everybody who worked in production was about the same age. We were all in our mid-20s, late-20s. We all loved working for the show. We all loved the history of the show. It was just – it was an amazing time, and It was nerve-wracking for the first year because I didn't know World Turns that much. I didn't watch it growing up. I had to do a lot of research and a lot of reading on the history. But, you know, once Hogan came in and things took a turn, it was really just a magical experience. I mean, that sounds so cheesy to say, but it's really true.
Well, you know, as someone who was watching back then, you could see it on screen.
Well, yeah, and everybody was so – all the actors were so excited. There was just this vibe in the studio. Everybody was excited to come to work, and we all used to go out on Friday nights after taping and Saturday nights, and, like, it was just a great group. I can't say enough good things. All those people you see in the credits at the end of World Turns, I know you don't know who they are. That's fine. I'm telling you, they're the best people ever. They're the best people ever, and they love that show more than anything.
Awesome.
Well, it's
funny
you
mentioned Ellen.
I know there's
some doubt about that lately, but it's true. They really do.
It's funny you mentioned Ellen. The three of us on the Daytime Confidential CBS Days podcast were thrilled with the episodes leading up to and during Katie Peretti's wedding, and one of my main reasons
that.
Yes, to Brad.
The wedding to Brad.
her most recent wedding, yes. And, I mean, Ellen Dolan was great. You know, I started watching when Another World was canceled, and I'd always heard such great things about Tom and Margo, but I never really saw a really front-burner storyline with her. I mean, I got some glimpses of, you know, the feud with Emily and things like that, but this was the first time that I really got to see her play really strong and funny and everything. And I mean, I was so impressed and am a big fan of hers.
She's wonderful. I mean, and she's definitely one of those underrated actresses that you know, it there's a lot of that kind of actor on that show. Ben Hendrickson was also another one who, you know, was so underrated for years because he never had that one big explosion of an episode. Mm-hmm. But he was consistently in character all the time, and he was somebody you could immediately identify with. And Margot was the same way. Like,
mm-hmm.
You know, even when she's given such a supporting role in a scene, Ellen gives it her all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's so wonderful. Like, you know, all personal feelings about her storyline or whatever are immediately put aside when the cameras start rolling. You know, okay. And it's just fantastic. And that's why I love that show so much, because all the actors in the cast are like that.
After your time at one, excuse me, you next worked as a script writer and later an associate head writer for One Life to Live. Tell us about that experience.
Yeah, I was actually never a script writer, and like somehow that's on the internet, and I'm not sure how that happened.
Okay.
I think I vaguely remember this. My first episode as a breakdown writer, they mistakenly put my name in the script writer slot.
Oh, okay.
But I was never actually a script writer. I was.
Gotta love Wikipedia.
Yeah. No, it's good because I know a few other sites had it listed as scriptwriter because I was listed in that slot, but I never was. It was One Life was really tough for me, and not in a negative way. It was, you know, I'd gone from another world to World Turns, and I'd really been helped by this group of people in charge who really liked me and wanted to see me succeed. And Hogan had given me a piece of advice, and actually Chris Galvin gave me the same piece of advice too, separately, right before I left, where they said, you know, unfortunately, and I totally understand this, I'm not saying this in like a negative way, unfortunately they're always going to see you as the 22-year-old who got them lunch in another world. Hmm. Like, that's how they see you, that's how they perceive you, and no matter how many episodes you write, and no matter how much they like them, they're not going to want to lose you in that capacity because you're always, you know, really friendly and, you know, really good at what you do as an assistant. And so the best thing you can do really is to leave, like go off to college, as mm-hmm. Hogan put it, you know, go off to college and prove you can do this. So One Life was like a real challenge for me because it was the first time I've been working in soaps that didn't involve Chris Galvin or Carolyn Culleton or Leah or Hogan or, you know, all these people who, you know, I got along with. It was, you know, mm-hmm. time for me to prove that I could do this no matter where I worked, where I was hired. And One Life was tough. You know, I started there in the middle of a really shaky head writer transition. I worked with Michael and Josh for maybe 3 or 4 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And then Josh quit, and then Michael was fired. Then there were like 2 weeks where there was no head writer, and then Dina came in, and it was a tough transition for anybody. You know, I'm not, you know, blaming anyone. I mean, I totally sympathize with everything Michael and Josh were going through and what Dina went through coming in, just because it was a weird time. You know, it's mm-hmm. always weird when those head writer transitions happen. But I loved it. I loved it. There were definitely, like, hurdles for me to jump over in my 2 years there. But just knowing that I was capable of doing this without somebody holding my hand like they were at World Turns was just really great. And I didn't always succeed. Sometimes I wrote bad episodes, and I totally fess up to that. But you know, when they were good, they were good, and I was grateful for that. I was grateful that they gave me the chance.
Now, for fans who don't know, what is exactly is the difference between a breakdown writer and an associate head writer?
There isn't a whole lot of difference, to be honest with you. It's more of a seniority thing. Associate head writers write breakdowns just like breakdown writers. Technically, associate head writers have a little more say in long story and are a little more free to throw ideas out. I just happen to work at shows where the fact that I was a breakdown writer, the head writer wasn't offended by the fact that I would throw ideas out the same way that an associate head writer would do. But it's really pretty much the same thing. Associate head writers will step in and fill in blanks in long story when needed, are given a little more freedom when they write their episodes. I always say, like, I was never really an associate head writer at One Life. I was pretty much just a breakdown writer, but when I got to Days, I was an associate head writer just because I had a lot more say in the scenes that I wrote in each episode.
Okay.
But that's really the difference. And associate head writer writes breakdowns just like a breakdown writer does.
Okay.
It's really kind of the same thing. It's just more of a seniority thing.
after your time at One Life, you went to Young and the Restless, where you wrote for someone who you said on your blog was one of your childhood idols, Kay Alden. Was that surreal for you?
It was great. Well, the thing is, when I worked at YNR, Lynn was the head writer.
Oh, was she? Okay.
Yeah, and Kay was a consultant. And I got to tell you, Kay was – I never actually met her in person, and honestly, I can't wait to meet her in person because she used to spend Saturday nights at 11 o'clock at night on the phone with me, helping me with history and helping me brainstorm and shoot ideas back and forth, and I was so, like, grateful for that. I was so grateful. Like, she was just wonderful. Like, I really wanted to make it work at YNR, and she clearly wanted to help me make it work. And it was just fantastic because she has such a for all of her studying under Bill Bell, who to me is one of the most intricate, complex storytellers in daytime, she has a very simplistic way of saying something to you or getting an idea across to you. And it's very simple and basic, and you're like, oh, that makes sense. And so, like, it really, like, it floored me because I always thought there was always these, like, you know, there had to be all these intense conversations behind the scenes at YNR about character motivation. And it was actually a lot simpler, and rightfully so, a lot simpler than I was making it. You know, I wanted to, like, look at all angles, and sometimes that's the worst thing a writer can do. You know, sometimes it's just a very simple through line. Mm-hmm. And the more perspectives you try and squeeze in there, the more you're seen it all over the map. It doesn't make any sense. So Kay always, like, said, all right, you're getting a little too out of control. Like, come down to earth. This character wants this. This character wants this. And they're going to converge here. And that's all this scene is.
Okay.
And sometimes, you know, it's Occam's razor. The simplest answer is the right answer.
This sort of brings us to your time on Days of Our Lives, where you once again worked with Hogan Scheffer. A lot of soap critics, including TV Guide Canada's Nelson Branco, refuse to believe to this day that the days we saw on our screen during that time was actually Hogan Scheffer's vision for the show. Given the brilliant things that he and his team did in terms of turning around As the World Turns, is there any truth to the theory that there were network or corporate influences going on that were tying Hogan's hands?
Oh, yeah, of course there were. Okay, yeah, of course there were. And I've been criticized lately for my defense of Hogan. And there's always network interference at every show at varying degrees, at varying levels. There's always network interference. Sometimes it's really light. Sometimes it's not. And, you know, it's really micromanaged. And they you know, study every line of dialogue you write. There's a lot of stuff going on right now with Days that is completely out of everybody's control in terms of how long it's going to be on the air and the cancellation, and no one knows what the magic answer is. So Hogan was hired to turn the show around, and over the course of the next year, there were a lot of budget constraints put on us. There was a lot of backpedaling when things didn't work out the way he wanted them to. There was a lot of scrambling. And it's nobody's fault. This is not Ken's fault or Steve Wyman's fault or Ed Scott's fault. It was just that the show was in a weird time. They knew that, you know, D-Day was coming up and they were going to find out about their cancellation. And it was like, we got to pull out all the stops. And no one really knew what the right answer was, but, you know, we were sure as hell going to try and find it. Yeah, I mean, I could totally get into, like, you know, all the things that I heard that went on there and, you know, the things I overheard when I was at Hogan's house in L.A. But, like, honestly, it's just everybody who works at Days really wants to keep that show on the air, and they're willing to try anything to do it. And if it's not working immediately, they're going to change it. Mm-hmm. Immediately. And so you're going to get a lack of continuity and you know, a bit of confusion from the fans because stories change halfway through and whatnot. And I really, honestly, there's so many things that I would love to go back and change that we did at Days. So many things. There were things that I thought we did fantastic and other things that I thought, like, oh, this wasn't what it was supposed to be at all. But, you know, I understand why it happened. I understand why that interference steps in. You know, there's a general panic, and that's not mm-hmm. like a trade secret for me to reveal. Everybody's worried about, will the show get picked up in 2009?
Right.
You know, NBC publicly said it's unlikely a year ago. So I understand why there's a panic. I understand why there might be some strange decisions made behind the scenes, because that's what happens when you're in that position. So, you know, I mean, I'm not totally, like, blind when it comes to Hogan. I'm aware of the mistakes we made in the last year. But, yeah, there was a lot of network interference. He was hired to bring the show to another level, and I feel like in some ways we did succeed in terms of dialogue and in terms of evolving characters past a one-note character. But, you know, some things didn't work. And, you know, unfortunately, we didn't have the luxury of time to fix things.
Okay.
If that answers your question, I'm not sure if it does. But.
Yes, it does. It does. It's just curious because it's one of those things where you want to learn about what's going on because there's so many questions and rumors and things that go on. So any opportunity to pick someone's mind, we appreciate it.
Yeah, no, and I've been kind of vocal. I mean, I haven't been that vocal. There's still some things that I, you know, don't say in interviews just because it's unprofessional. But, yeah, I mean, there was definitely, you know, everybody universally agreed that Hogan's first 3 months were really strong, and they were. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't even on the team then. I was still working at YNR during that time. When I came on, I remember I flew out to California in my first week writing just to hang out with Hogan and to meet Ken and to meet Steve Wyman and introduce myself and get some FaceTime. And that was the week that the mandate came down that we couldn't play the Big Four. And I remember staying at Hogan's house and how frustrated he was that the Big Four, John Marlin and Bowen Hope, had to be backburnered because
wow.
of money. You know, and he had written these huge, long stories, and we were right in the middle of them, and we had to kill everything. And it wasn't just the Big Four. It was, you know, the Carvers were out, the Lockharts were out, the Big Four, one day a week.
Man.
And
they swore
like,
up and down in the...
Yeah.
They swore up and down in the soap press that was not happening.
I'm saying this because I've said it before, so...
Oh, yeah. No. Well, we appreciate
like,
that.
Honestly, it's true. Like, and I remember when it happened, and all of his long stories had to be stopped short.
And what logic would be behind backburnering your two most popular couples at a time when the show is struggling?
That, I don't know. I wasn't a part of those meetings. I just know it from Hogan's end.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really frustrating. It was really frustrating, but, you know, he was really angry for a whole 24 hours, and then 24 hours later he said, you know what? We'll do this. We're just going to do it. That's my job. My job is to do it.
One decision that proved very unpopular with a lot of the fans was the decision to kill off John Black. However, John's funeral episodes were some of the best scenes we'd had on Days in a long time, and I understand you had a strong part in writing those episodes.
Thank you. You do my ego good. Thank you.
Oh, I mean, I'm serious. It really was. Great stuff. I mean, the stuff with Victor coming in and them throwing us that history nod. I mean, it was just, it wasn't Days that we were used to for the last decade with people talking to themselves and microchips and things like that. I mean, it was really good, meaty drama.
All right, you're going to be all mushy now. I mean, honestly, I you know, Hogan is very detailed in his notes to the breakdown writers. So a lot of times he gave us so much stuff to work with. It was more of a case of, you know, editing things out than it was adding stuff. Because I've worked for some head writers where they don't give you nearly enough and you have to totally make it up on the fly. But Hogan always gave us too much, so we had to edit. And I had written the episode. It's the episode that started with Marlena and Belle on the street with John, which was like four episodes before he actually died, the three episodes. And I wrote that episode, and I called up Hogan, and I was like, I know this is really, like, forward of me, and I apologize. I'm like, if you're going to do a funeral, can I write it? And he said, absolutely. He was like, you want it? You can take it. He's like, you know this show. And I was like, all right. I'm like, I kind of have it all in my head, though, because I really did. Like, the second I knew John was going to die, I saw the whole thing. I saw it opening with the flashback on the pier. Like, the whole thing just, like, jumped into my brain, and I was like, oh, I totally want to do this. And he said the only thing that he wanted out of that episode was for Lucas to give Sammy the okay to marry EJ, to get Stefano off their backs, and he wanted EJ to have a moment where his conscience set in about everything he had done. He was like, those are the only two things that I want in that episode. Everything else is up to you. And it was every fan's dream. Like, I sat down and I pounded this thing out and I had such a blast and such a good time. And it was way too long. It was like 30 minutes too long. And so they made it two episodes. And I was really fuzzy on the John Hope history because I was working at World Turns during that story and didn't really understand the whole John Hope, Princess Gina thing.
No, it was nothing to miss.
Right? And so Christian called me through the writer's assistant, and she was like, I kind of want to add some things to my eulogy. And she was really timid about it, and I was like, no, I love this. I love collaboration. Like, let's talk about it. Let's talk about what you want in the eulogy. Like, and, you know, we talked on the phone, and I flew out there, and I met her in person, and I was like, and she was so like, I don't want to tell you how to do your job. And she was like, no. I was like, I know, I love that. I love that. I love talking to the actors and getting their take and adding things and subtracting things and making it a real, like, team effort. And, you know, if nothing else, thank you, thank you, thank you, Days of Our Lives, for letting me do those two episodes, because I just, it was a dream come true for me.
You would think more writers would be like that. You have with, you know, we see that there's a kind of a revolving door with writers coming in and out, but these people have played these parts for 20-odd years, 30-odd years. You'd think that more writers would embrace sitting down with the Christian Alfonsos and the Deirdre Halls and the Eric Bradens to ask them about these characters that they know better than anyone.
Well, to be fair, there are a number of actors at all the shows who will schedule meetings with the head writer and pitch their idea of a story that basically involves three or four people of the opposite sex falling in love with them and fighting over them.
That would be a problem.
So I do understand, as a writer, now that I've worked in these rooms, where that, like, defense mechanism comes from, where you put your wall up and you're like, ew, I don't want to hear what you have to say.
It's a double-edged sword, then.
Yes, and it really is a, like, you have to take each case as it comes. You know, because eventually you figure out who the actors are who genuinely care about the ensemble aspect of the show and have an idea or a suggestion that will help everybody and not just them. And you also learn the actors who are all about making them look better. So, okay. I mean, there is definitely, like, you know, there's two ways to look at it. So I do understand why some actors, well, why some writers ignore some actors when they say, I have a story idea.
I'm telling you, you should write a book. I've said it before.
Yeah, I can't right now. I've said too much already. People already, like, have put a warrant out for my head, so someday. And I'm not the one to write the book. Honestly, there's so many other people who have way crazier stories to tell than I do.
Oh, I can imagine with this industry.
Well, I sort of want to bring that up because you have mentioned that you've said things on your blog, and it was shortly after your the episodes, if I'm not mistaken, with John's death that the writer's strike went into effect. During the strike, you sort of gave voice to the daytime writers via your blog on myspace.com/TommyCAS. Did you expect your words to travel across cyberspace quite as fast as they did and make such an impact?
No, and they didn't originally. I never expected it because I started that blog the first week I started at Days. And I never publicized it. I never posted on a message board saying, check out this new blog. I just started it just as, you know, a way for me to talk about how cool it was that I was writing the show that I grew up on. I mean, I grew up on a lot of shows, but Days was always really close to my heart. And so I started this blog, and I would get, like, 30 or 40 hits a week, and I would kind of troll the message boards, and nobody ever brought it up, and I thought, well, whoever these 30 or 40 people are, they're not spilling it to the general internet populace. And, you know, I met a few people who would email me privately, Jamie being one of them. But it was never like, I never did it to for self-promotion or to get myself noticed. And then when the strike happens, the strike was really tough because suddenly we were all sitting at home on our couches or walking in a circle in a picket line. And there was no outlet for anything we were feeling. And so I kept the blog going about the strike, and it, and still nobody really noticed it. No one said anything. I think a couple times Roger at WeLoveSoaps.com would post an entry, a blog entry about, you know, a picket line day or something. But again, it was never really noticed or anything. And I remember, I totally remember the day that I posted the goodbye letter when I got fired. And within 6 hours, it climbed to 3,000 hits. And I was in a total panic. I was like, "What? This is crazy. Like, I don't know what to do. I have no idea how to, like, handle this. I have no idea how to, you know, I did not want to be the voice of striking writers. Like, it was just an outlet for me. And for months and months and months, nobody noticed it.
Either that or else it was the right 40 people who were watching.
I guess. It was crazy. And I was worried how it would make me look, to be perfectly honest. I was worried it made me look like I was, you know, self-promoting myself or whatever. You know, a lot of people wanted interviews. A lot of people wanted to talk to me. And it was messy. It was crazy. And the thing is, like, those of us who were fired from Days suddenly became like these poster children for the strike. Because we were really the only show it happened to. It did happen at YNR, but it happened at YNR like a second after the strike ended. Like, we're the only ones that it happened to previously to the strike ending. And so all of a sudden, everything I had written for the last 14 months suddenly became like, I don't want to say evidence, that's a really melodramatic word, but it was really scrutinized. And I never expected that. And I never gave away spoilers. I never gave away long story. I never, like, you know, spilled any gossip that I shouldn't have. I never did, ever. And then I really noticed that, like, having come from, to bring it full circle, having come from, you know, growing up with the internet in my house and, like, posting on these message boards and then getting a job in soaps and becoming one of the idiots in control, like, I could see both sides of it. And I'm not saying one side is right and one side is wrong, but I can see both sides of it. And now I understand a lot more than I did when I was just posting on message boards, but I still think there are things people are saying on message boards that soap writers should be paying attention to, and they're not. Mm-hmm. And I thought, there's no connection here. And there's really like there's a stigma against the fans, most soaps, in terms of, you know, they sent, you know, 20,000 boxes of mac and cheese. And, you know, that's being handled by some 19-year-old in the production office who's just grumbling and moaning because they now have to deal with 20,000 boxes of mac and cheese. Like, that's who has to deal with that. So They're bitching about the fans. The fans are bitching about the idiots in control. And I thought, wow, like, there's this weird thing because we're both groups are dependent on each other. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, they don't like each other.
Right.
And that's crazy. Like, that's not the way it should be. And I, you know, I'm not saying at all that I will do everything that every fan ever asked me to do. Mm-hmm. You know, just because somebody posts something on a message board doesn't mean I should automatically, like, write it in the next episode. But if, you know, 80 people on 4 different message boards are saying the same thing, like, that's something to pay attention to.
One thing I've noticed in my traveling of various message boards is that even shows that are, like, at a creative zenith that, you know, whether it be YNR back when it was just the golden show, if you go to their message boards, you still see the same people doing the exact same thing on the shows that people consider bad. They're calling them the idiots in control. And
I've always said, like, I would pay money. And before I say this, let me preface it by saying I think Doug Marland is a genius. But I really, truly wonder what his reputation would be after his death had the internet existed in full force during Carolyn Crawford, which was like his last big story before he died. The murder mystery that went on for 18 months that with a lot of – all the suspects were non-contract newbies. And it's considered by most to be like the one story that Doug Marlin, you know, didn't succeed at, which is fine. There's nothing wrong with that. Agnes Nixon, Bill Bell, they all have their clunkers, you know, over the course of their careers. But I wonder, like, had the internet existed, would people give him like the sainthood title that they have today? And I'm glad he has that title. I think he deserves it. But the way fans can turn on a writer in a heartbeat.
Oh, yeah.
I really wonder.
Yeah.
You know, I do think the internet has done some bad, some great, but some bad.
Well, one thing your blog did definitely was put a human face on the situation with the strike for your readers. No one could go away from reading one of your posts and say, well, I don't care. I just want my soaps to stay on, which is something I probably would have said, you know, 10 years ago, because I didn't grow up with the internet. You know, whenever there was an issue with Hollywood, your mind is – you're automatically taught to envy whoever's made it in Hollywood. So you're like, oh, they just need to get back to the table. But reading your blogs really showed that these were real people with real families and that were fighting for something that they believed in. Have you heard from a lot of fans who have said things like that, that, you know, you helped them understand what the writers were fighting for?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And the thing is, the weird thing about the strike for me, and fortunately I just said this in a guild meeting last week, so I don't mind saying it now. Here's the thing. When you write your first episode ever, you get a phone call from the guild saying, we need a check from you immediately. You're required to join the guild.
Mm-hmm.
And so my feelings on the union for the first, like, 8 years I was writing were not that positive. Yes, they were the people who gave me health insurance, which is cool. But these are the people who just kept hounding me to send them checks and send them money. Because they don't take the dues out of your paycheck. You have to, like, every 3 months calculate how much you owe them and send them a check. And I just thought, like, who are these people just taking my money? Like, what are they doing? And for the first 2 weeks of the strike, I just sat in my apartment. I was like, okay, I'm not working anymore. I'm just going to sit here and watch TV and play video games. it was naive of me, and it was stupid of me, and I totally admit that. And then I talked to a few people who pointed out that Days had been on iTunes for $2 an episode for almost the full year that I was writing for them. And Days more so than any other soap. Like, I can see the fuzzy gray area for like CBS and ABC because they air their shows on their websites, but you don't pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
So I understand why that's like, well, do they really make money off of that? Is it just an added bonus? Like, I understand that. But Days is a different story because people are paying $2 per episode to watch that episode. And mm-hmm. 3 weeks after the Shell Wedding on Thanksgiving, the Shell Wedding was still the number one downloaded episode on iTunes for Days.
Wow.
And I wrote that episode, and I thought, okay, like, this is what they're talking about. Like, this really
now, are you meaning,
me.
Just to clarify for me, because I, you know, Luke's a techno genius, but I struggle. Now, this was the number one for both daytime and primetime, like with a primetime show?
No, it was just number one. They tell you when you go on iTunes what the top five downloaded episodes of a TV show are.
Okay.
And my assumption was always the top five episodes of a downloaded TV show are going to be the last five episodes in order.
Mm-hmm.
Because the most people are going to download the last aired episode. That was my assumption.
Okay.
But when I went onto iTunes on like December 12th, and the number one downloaded Days of Our Lives episode was still the Shell Wedding on Thanksgiving.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
I thought, well, that proves that people aren't downloading episodes immediately after they air.
Mm-hmm.
They're downloading episodes weeks later, having heard good buzz from their friends, from the internet, from whatever, about that episode. And I thought, well, this really does affect me because you know,
where's your cut?
Yeah, well, and that's the thing. Like, yes, I'm aware we make a lot of money. I'm not saying we don't make a lot of money. And I'm not one of these people who's going to bitch about, like, you know, my $800 haircuts because my haircuts are $14. But honestly, like, we go through long periods in our career where we're unemployed, and we survive only on residual checks. And the guild was only asking 2% of what they make. And I thought, that's not outlandish. 2% is not a crazy number.
Well,
they're just saying, if you get paid, we should get paid.
Right.
And that sort of leads me to my next question. Why do you think it is that the industry is so reluctant to pay writers for products that are either downloaded or streamed or whatever the case may be, when they could insert advertising, or in the case of the CBS and ABC websites, they actually have advertising at various points throughout the episode? Why do you think they're so reluctant to pay it out?
Well, there's a few different answers to that. Number one, I think they've been getting a lot of free money for like 4 or 5 years now.
That makes sense.
The other part of it is, and I totally get that, but the other part of it is, it's the actors too. You know, SAG and AFTRA's contracts are up in another month.
Right.
And they're going to want the same things. And here's the thing. Writers, and, you know, every time you see a flashback, writers, directors, actors all get like 2%. That's why it's so hard to find, like, anniversary episodes of soaps that have so many flashbacks, because nobody wants to spend the money on paying all those directors and writers who no longer work in daytime.
Oh, okay.
Actors, however, especially film actors and primetime actors, not as low in numbers. You know, some people have it in their contracts that it's like 20%, 30%, 40%. And I'm talking about your, like, A-list actors. And I think a lot of what happened with the writer's strike was trying to set an example for the actors, because they knew they were going to face this same fight in another 2 months. A lot of actors have a lot more invested in their projects than writers do.
Well, and that sort of leads to a follow-up question I want to ask about, because the primetime shows where you have 22 episodes, lots of primetime advertising dollars, and a plethora of money is a lot different than the daytime industry, which is every single day, and writers are cranking it out left and right to get episodes on the air. And the daytime industry, which is already suffering, could have been dealt a huge blow if things had gotten even worse. Do you think that there's some sort of disparity between the standards that the people who write in daytime are held to as opposed to their brethren in movies in primetime?
Well, our contract is up. The union's contract is up every 3 years. And every 3 years since I started working in this business, there's been buzz about a strike. It's never come to pass until this year, but there's always been buzz. But every time there's been buzz about it, it's always been about things like raising the DVD percentage, which really, truly does not affect daytime.
At all.
At all. At all. Please don't ask me who, but I know for a fact there were people who I really respect and admire who did scab during the 88 strike, because they went on strike in May, which was primetime's summer hiatus anyway. So they were already on vacation. So they went on strike during their vacation. And you know, a lot of daytime writers said, this is about DVD sales and VHS sales. It doesn't involve us. Like, we're going to keep writing. However, this time around, it did affect us. It absolutely affected us. And those same people that I know told me years ago, like, yeah, I wrote during the 88 strike, were on the picket line every single day. Mm-hmm. Because they said, finally, like, there's something the Writers Guild is fighting for that directly affects us. You know, we don't know where the internet's going to be in 5 years or 10 years. We don't know where daytime's going to be in 5 years or 10 years. Everything's really precarious right now. But there's going to be something on the internet. There already is something on the internet. It's already happening.
Saying that, yeah, that's where it's going to be.
Yeah. And I don't know if I agree with that completely, but there's going to be something on the internet.
And now you have soap critics who are saying that the strike was good for the industry for daytime, saying things like that because of the ratings resurgence at Days and other shows, that it was actually good for the industry. And I can't imagine that's a good thing to hear for the striking writers. What's your take on that?
My honest take on it? And again, I'm one of those people who likes to look at a situation from all sides and loves playing devil's advocate. I understand what they're saying and why they're saying it. I get it. I understand that there was a resurgence in some shows during the strike because, well, mainly, okay, any soap fan will tell you that during a head writer transition, no matter how messy it is behind the scenes, it's always must-watch on the air. Because basically, they're bringing like five of the old head writer stories to a huge conclusion when they start.
Good point.
Uh-huh.
I've seen it over and over and over again. When a new head writer starts, they bring all the old head writer stories to like a huge finish in their first month. And of course, it's must-see every day because things are really happening. So I totally get that. I totally understand that. And that's what happened at a few shows and Days included. I don't know. I really respect a lot of the people in the soap press. I know a lot of them personally. I really respect them. I understand the weird position they're in. They want to be honest, but at the same time, they don't want to alienate the shows for future, you know, gossip. But they understand things that fans don't. Like, they know what goes on behind the scenes. And for them to oversimplify it to this is the best thing that could happen is wrong. It's totally wrong. You know, of course Days did great in February because all of Hogan's stories came to a huge, great climax.
Mm-hmm.
And you had to watch every day. You know, that's – I totally get it. I totally get it. And I actually expected it. Before February Sweeps, I was like, Days is going to have a great February Sweeps because it's going to be like, you know, you cannot miss a day. You cannot miss a day because it's going to be trying to get rid of all of Hogan's stories, and it's going to be must-see every day, and there's always going to be a cliffhanger, and it's going to be nonstop, like, zaniness. And that's exactly how it happened, and I totally get it. Honestly, that's not my biggest gripe post-strike.
What is?
The whole, like, the breakdown situation. The breakdown situation. And I'm not just saying that because my position has been eliminated. Like, that's really
right.
That's not
to clarify for people who don't know, that that issue is that basically the strike has shown the idiots in charge. I'll say that for this time. I usually don't use that term, but in this time I will. That it's basically shown them that they can get along with less writers, so now they're doing away with the position of breakdown writer. So expound on that for us.
Yeah, I mean, basically at most soaps, there's still a few soaps that still have breakdown writers, and I love them for it. Thank you, GH and One Life. I love you. Most shows have decided to save money that the head writers are going to write all five breakdowns every week. Okay, because I already know what people are going to say. Yes, Doug Marland wrote all of his breakdowns. There was a time when Agnes Nixon wrote all of her breakdowns. Absolutely. What is a diplomatic way to say this? You're talking about writers who eat, sleep, and breathe these fictional towns.
Mm-hmm.
Those artists, those people who are devoted 110% to this genre don't exist anymore. And that's not a disparaging comment against the head writers in charge right now, because I know a lot of the head writers at all the shows, and they're all wonderful people. It's just that they have families and children and lives, and as much as they might want to devote all that time to their show, they just can't. They just can't. So to save money, they've gotten rid of the breakdown writers. Head writers are writing all five breakdowns, and I think it's going to be fine for the next 6 months, but I think eventually they're going to burn out. They're just going to burn out. You know, and that's not again, that's not a negative statement on them. I would burn out, too. If I was the head writer and I had to write all five breakdowns, I would hit a point where I knew I had to write five scenes of romance between a couple and be like, I'm out of ideas. Like, let's steal the moment from Say Anything, and he holds a boombox over his head. Like, because you just, you know, it's 2 a.m, and you're on the fifth breakdown, and you're like, ugh, what's original and romantic? I don't know, blah, 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 you know, and you just spew it out. You know, and I think that's what's going to happen, because the thing about breakdown writers is it's a different pair of eyes. A head writer can be exhausted and be at the end of their rope and write you and say, do you have any ideas about these two characters? We have to play them. What do you think? And you can call them or write them back and say, what about, you know, X, Y, and Z? And they're like, oh, I love it. Thank you. And you have a new set of eyes, you know, who isn't up until all hours in the morning trying to figure out your next week of episodes. I do think writing teams got a little too big. I do think 6 or 7 breakdown writers is kind of ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of love Bob Guz's business model of 3 breakdown writers. I think it's a great idea. Because you have 3 people who really know what the head writer wants, whether the fans like it or not. And you have, you know, 3 writers who know what the head writer wants, knows what his vision is, and they can follow through on it.
Well, I wanted to ask you about something, because Days of Our Lives and All My Children are both being investigated for staffing practices during the strike. If given the opportunity, would you go back to Days?
You're the first person to ask me that question.
Hey.
Wow. Luke, you've stumped me. I don't know the answer to that. I would love to go back to Days. I would love it. I loved working with Ed Scott. I love working with Noah Maxim. I love working with those actors. I loved being part of taking Days to a different level. You know, I respect Riley for the influence and contribution he made to Daytime once. But mm-hmm. I do feel like when we all got hired at Days, it was time for Days to be taken seriously again and not be campy. And I would love to be part of that again. I would love it. I would love it. I would love it. Having said that, I don't know if that's where Days is heading right now. Days is all, and rightfully so, Days is all about staying on the air right now. It's all about staying on the air. It's all about, like event after event after event to keep people interested and watching, people getting shot, people getting, like, stabbed, people, you know, having sex for no rhyme or reason because it's things to see on the screen. But I get it. I understand. I'm not putting it down. I understand why they're doing that, because it's all about staying on the air. You know, nobody's focusing on, well, what will this mean for the story 2 years from now? Because Days doesn't know if it has it 2 years from now.
Right.
So they're just trying to keep those ratings up so they don't get canceled. They don't have that luxury. So I would love to go back to Days someday. I would love it. I would love it. I don't think they'd ever hire me back, but I would love it. It was the show I grew up on. It's a show I still watch day after day, even after getting fired. I still watch it every day because I love those characters. I love those actors. It's you know, it's part of me. It's part of my life, and I'll always watch it. And I would love to go back, but I would only want to go back if I could take the time to really explore character development. You know, and there's just no place for that now because they can't.
Well, as we mentioned earlier, and we talked about in great deal, but I wanted to kind of go back to it a little bit. One of the big sticking points for the writer's strike was web content. With you being between soaps, could we see an internet soap written by Tom Casciallo in the future?
I have really thought about it. Honestly, I would love to do it. The thing is, I don't have the capital. And that's the problem most writers have, because, you know, once the ratification happened and the contract went into effect, a lot of Daytime writers who were fired – especially all the breakdown writers who are now out of work, would love to do that. The problem is we don't have the capital to put up to do it. I would love to do an internet soap. I think what Eden Riegel is doing right now
is that not
amazing
or what?
I think it's awesome. I think it's incredible. And here's the thing. And this is not – don't read between the lines here because I'm making a general statement, not a specific one. Whatever she does, whatever her and her husband do with that, even if it doesn't work in certain episodes, I still love her for doing it.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's opening doors. She's opening doors for everybody. And it might not always be a great episode. It might not always be a funny episode. But I love her for jumping in and doing it. Karen Harris just did it.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And I love her for doing it. And that is something that every soap fan should check out because I have read that script. I haven't seen the finished product, but I read the script, and it's awesome. It's called
Life in General.
Life in General. And I got to tell you, first of all, please don't take anything that's in there as, like, proof of what goes on at General Hospital. That's all stuff. That's all stuff she's taken from numerous jobs at numerous soaps. So, like, it's please don't think that she's writing about GH because she's not writing just about GH.
And I think there's enough cliches in soaps that it doesn't matter which soap you're on, it fits.
Yeah, exactly. And I love them for doing this. I love them for doing it because it opens doors for all of us. You know, again, we don't really understand or know yet how much market there is out there for it. I am working on a project right now that I'm kind of sort of obsessed with, to be honest.
Oh, wow. Can you tell us?
It's a pitch that I'm making with two writing partners who are wonderful, who I went through the ABC development program with, okay. Who are awesome, who are great. And we've been working on this for a while, and we're going to make a pitch to a few different networks at the end of the month. And it is I've written things outside of soaps that I've been like, whatever. I'm not really attached to it. This I'm really attached to. I think it's really cool, and I think soap fans will love it. And it's a statement on soap fans and soap actors, and it's a lot of fun and really interesting. And I hope it takes off. And I don't want to say too much more, but I'm kind of in love with it, and I hope that that somebody else is too.
Well, listen, when you get it ready to promote, you know, you can definitely come back here and talk to us about it.
Oh, and, right on. Thank you, guys.
And we will be
thank
more than
so
happy
much.
To put it on the blog as well, because we enjoyed Imaginary Bitches, and it seems to be doing well, and we're more than willing to help promote quality projects of people who are in daytime.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate it. I would love to continue in daytime. Post-strike, it was a real eye-opening experience because I realized I need to accept the fact I might not get a job in daytime again. And I need to be okay with that. I was very vocal during the strike, even though I didn't plan to be. Politically, that doesn't bode well for me. So I need to be okay with that. You know?
Well, you gave a voice that needed to be heard, so... no one can ever – karmically, you definitely will reap good reward no matter what the politics of – you know. So I feel like good writers will find ways to share their stories. I definitely hope that you will be back on a writing staff soon. We appreciate you taking the time out to talk with us tonight.
Oh, my pleasure. I hope I didn't ramble too much. I tend to go off on tangents when it comes to soap,
no.
So I hope I didn't.
You didn't ramble at all. We're more than happy to listen.
I've had interviews where I've gone like 3 or 4 hours, seriously.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yeah. No, I tend to like ramble forever about soaps because I love them so much. So.
Yeah, and they're the only genre. I mean, they're the oldest broadcast genre. So, I mean, there's so much to talk about.
Yeah. And we're really in the generation right now where everybody who's applying for jobs is a soap fan from the 80s.
Basically, yes.
So soaps need to really take a look at that and realize we need to change our hiring practices because the people who are coming out of film schools and screenwriting programs and whatnot, like, they're the ones who grew up with the internet.
Mm-hmm.
and watching, you know, Luke and Laura in the 80s. It's not like they were watching soaps in the 70s, which were also good, but not as in your face and not as aggressive. You know, the people who are applying for jobs now grew up in the 80s and 90s. They grew up with Jim Reilly and Marlena Possessed by the Devil and Carly Buried Alive and Reba Cloned, and they know what they like to watch and they know what they hated to watch. And they need to start looking at their hiring practices based on that.
Yep.
Because these are, it's no longer, you know, playwrights, like you said before. Mm-hmm. It used to be that it was like playwrights or people in primetime, people in film, and of course, there was a reason for that, but now it's different. We all witnessed the heyday of soaps.
Mm-hmm.
We saw Maxie BJ. You know,
yeah.
We saw Stone die of AIDS. We saw Marty get raped at the Spring Fling. Like, we grew up with this. And they're going to have to take that into consideration. And I hope they do. I really do. Because I think there's a lot of incredible imaginations out there. And I've really seen that with this blog. And talking to people. There's a lot of people out there who are just have so much to offer
yes.
the industry.
And oh, definitely.
They see that.
We see that on our blog every day. I mean, it's almost sometimes embarrassing when you're trying to spend your time like making a creative, thoughtful blog, and then someone in the comments window sums it up better than you ever could have.
Yeah, exactly. It happens all the time. Happens all the time with me. I'll spend like 3 pages blogging about something, and someone will write one sentence, and I'm like, oh, hey, I could have written that sentence.
Yeah.
That works just as well.
Well,
absolutely.
Tom, thank you so much for coming on, and we won't keep you too much tonight, but anytime you want to come on and share anything with us, just let us
yes.
know.
Thanks a lot,
thank
guys.
You
I really
so much.
Appreciate it. And you guys are awesome. Seriously, I love your website. I love your podcast. You guys do an amazing
well,
job.
Thank you.
I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you. We appreciate it.
As a soap employee.
Thank you. Thank you.
That's nice to know. We thank you so much.
Right on.
So long.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Right, have a good night, guys. You.